A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Concluded. She spoke haltingly. He could not see her through the mesh that covered the grill. There was only the low and rhythmic whimper of a voice of Eve. The same, everlastingly the same. And even a woman with two heads could not contrive new ways of courting evil, but could only pursue a mindless mimicry of the original. Still feeling the shame of his own behavior with the girl and the officers and corps, he found it hard to concentrate. Still, his hands shook as he listened. The rhythm of the words came dull and muffled through the grill, like the rhythm of distant hammering, spikes driven through palms, piercing timber. As Alter Christus, he sensed the weight of each burden for a moment before it passed on to the one who bore them all. There was the business about her mate. There were the murky and secret things, things to be wrapped in dirty newspaper and buried by night. That he could only make sense of a little of it seemed to make the horror worse. "If you are trying to say that you are guilty of abortion," he whispered, "I must tell you that the absolution is reserved to the bishop, and I can't—" He paused. There was a distant roaring and the faint snort growl of missiles being fired from the range.
"The Dread One, the Dread One," whined the old woman.
His scalp prickled, a sudden chill of unreasonable alarm. "Quickly, an act of contrition," he muttered. 10 aves, 10 paternosters for your penance. You'll have to repeat the confession again later, but now an act of contrition." He heard her murmuring from the other side of the grill. Swiftly, he breathed an absolution. "Te absolvat Dominus Iesus Christus, ego autem ius auctoritate te absolvo ab omni vinculo. Denique si absolvi potes, ex peccatis tuis, ego te absolvo in nomine Patris." Before he had finished, a light was shining through the thick curtain of the confessional door. The light grew brighter and brighter until the booth was full of bright noon. The curtain began to smoke.
"Wait, wait," he hissed. "Wait till it dies."
"Wait, wait, wait till it dies," echoed a strange, soft voice from beyond the grill.
It was not the voice of Mrs. Grails.
"Mrs. Grails? Mrs. Grails?"
She answered him in a thick-tongued, sleepy murmur.
"I never meant to. I never meant to. Never love. Love."
It trailed away. It was not the same voice that had answered him a moment ago.
"Now, quickly, run."
Not waiting to see that she heeded him, he bounded out of the confessional and ran down the aisle toward the altar of reservation. The light had dimmed, but it still roasted the skin with noon sun glare. How many seconds remained? The church was full of smoke. He vaulted into the sanctuary, stumbled over the first step, called it a genuflection, and went to the altar. With frantic hands, he removed the Christ-filled ciborium from the tabernacle, genuflected again before the presence, grabbed up the body of his God, and ran for it. The building fell in on him. When he awoke, there was nothing but dust. He was pinned to the ground at the waist. He lay on his belly in the dirt and tried to move. One arm was free, but the other was caught under the weight that held him down. His free hand still clutched the ciborium, but he had tipped it in falling and the top had come off, spilling several of the small hosts. The blast had swept him clean out of the church, he decided. He lay in sand and saw the remains of a rose bush caught in a rockfall. A rose remained attached to a branch of it. One of the salmon Armenians, he noticed. The petals were singed. There was a great roaring of engines in the sky, and blue lights kept winking through the dust. He felt no pain at first. He tried to crane his neck so as to get a look at the behemoth that sat on him. But then things started hurting. His eyes filmed. He cried out softly. He would not look back again. 5 tons of rock had tucked him in. It held whatever remained of him below the waist. He began recovering the little hosts. He moved his free arm gingerly. Cautiously, he picked each of them out of the sand. The wind threatened to send the small flakes of Christ wandering.
"Anyway, Lord, I tried," he thought. "Anyone needing the last rites? Viaticum? They'll have to drag themselves to me if they do. Or is anybody left?"
He could hear no voices above the terrible roaring. A trickle of blood kept seeping into his eyes. He wiped at it with his forearm, as to avoid staining the wafers with gory fingers.
Wrong blood, Lord. Mine, not yours. De alba me.
He returned most of the scattered victims of the vessel, but a few fugitive flakes eluded his reach. He stretched for them, but blacked out again.
Jesus, Mary, Joseph, help.
Faintly he heard an answer, distant and scarcely audible under the howling sky. It was the soft, strange voice he had heard in the confessional, and again it echoed his words.
Jesus, Mary, Joseph, help.
What? He cried. He called out several times, but no further answer came. The dust had begun sprinkling down. He replaced the lid of the ciborium to keep the dust from mingling with the wafers. He lay still for a time with his eyes closed. The trouble with being a priest was that eventually you had to take the advice you gave to others.
Nature imposes nothing that nature hasn't prepared you to bear. That's what I get for telling her what the Stoics said before I told her what God said, he thought.
There was little pain, but only a ferocious itching that came from the captive part of him. He tried to scratch. His fingers encountered only bare rock. He clawed at it for a moment, shuddered, and took his hand away. The itch was maddening. Bruised nerves flashed foolish demands for scratching. He felt very undignified.
Well, Dr. Coors, how do you know that the itch is not the more basic evil than the pain?
He laughed a little at that one. The laugh caused a sudden blackout. He clawed his way out of blackness to the accompaniment of someone screaming. Suddenly, the priest knew that the screaming was his own. Zerki was suddenly afraid. The itch had been transmuted into agony, but the screams had been those of raw terror, not of pain. There was agony now even in breathing. The agony persisted, but he could bear that. The dread had arisen from that last taste of inky blackness. The blackness seemed to brood over him, covet him, await him hungrily, a big black appetite with a yen for souls. Pain he could bear, but not that awful dark. Either there was something in it that should not be there, or there was something here that remained to be done. Once he surrendered to that darkness, there would be nothing he could do or undo. Ashamed of his fright, he tried to pray, but the prayers seemed somehow unprayerful, like apologies, but not petitions, as if the last prayer had already been said, the last canticle already sung. The fear persisted. Why? He tried to reason with it.
You've seen people die, Jeff, seen many people die. It looks easy. They taper off, and then there's a little spasm, and it's over. That inky dark gulf between Aham and Asti, blackest Styx, abyss between Lord and man. Listen, Jeff, you really believe there's something on the other side of it, don't you? Then why are you shaking so?
A verse from the Dies Irae drifted into mind, and it nagged at him. Quid sum miser tunc dicturus, quem patronum rogaturus, cum vix justus sit securus. What am I, who am wretched, then to say? Whom shall I ask to be my protector, since even the just man is scarcely safe? Vix securus? Why scarcely safe? Surely he would not damn the just. Then why are you shaking so?
Really, Dr. Coors, the evil to which even you should have referred was not suffering, but the unreasoning fear of suffering. Metus doloris. Take it together with its positive equivalent, the craving for worldly security, for Eden, and you might have your root of evil, Dr. Coors. To minimize suffering and to maximize security were natural and proper ends of society and Caesar. But then they became the only ends, somehow, and the only basis of law, a perversion. Inevitably, then, in seeking only them, we found only their opposites, maximum suffering and minimum security. The trouble with the world is me. Try that on yourself, my dear Coors. Thee, me, Adam, man, we. No worldly evil except that which is introduced into the world by man. Me, thee, Adam, us. With a little help from the father of lies. Blame anything, blame God even, but oh, don't blame me. Dr. Coors, the only evil in the world now, doctor, is the fact that the world no longer is. What pain hath wrought.
He laughed weakly again, and it brought the ink.
Me, us, Adam, but Christ, man, me. Me, us, Adam, but Christ, man, me, he said aloud. You know what, Pat? They'd, together, rather get nailed on it, but not alone. When they bleed, want company. Because why it is. Because why it is the same as Satan wants man full of hell. I mean, the same as Satan wants hell full of man, because Adam, and yet Christ, but still me. Listen, Pat.
This time it took longer to drive the inky dark away, but he had to make it clear to Pat before he went into it all the way.
Listen, Pat, because why it is I told her the baby had to is why I mean, Jesus never asked a man to do a damn thing that Jesus didn't do. Same as why I can't let go. Pat?
He blinked several times. Pat vanished. The world congealed again, and the blackness was gone. Somehow he had discovered what he was afraid of. There was something he had yet to fulfill, before that dark closed over him forever.
Dear God, let me live long enough to fulfill it.
He was afraid to die before he had accepted as much suffering as that which came to the child who could not comprehend it. The child he had tried to save for further suffering. No, not for it, but in spite of it. He had commanded the mother in the name of Christ. He had not been wrong. But now he was afraid to slide away into that blackness before he had endured as much as God might help him endure. Quem patronum rogaturus, cum vix justus sit securus.
Let it be for the child and her mother, then. What I impose, I must accept. Fas est.
The decision seemed to diminish the pain. He lay quietly for a time, then cautiously looked back at the rock heap again. More than 5 tons back there, 18 centuries back there, the blast had broken open the crypts, for he noticed a few bones caught between the rocks. He groped with his free hand, encountered something smooth, and finally worked it free. He dropped it in the sand beside the ciborium. The jawbone was missing, but the cranium was intact, except for a hole in the forehead, from which a sliver of dry and half-rotten wood protruded. It looked like the remains of an arrow. The skull seemed very old.
"Brother,"
he whispered, for none but a monk of the order would have been buried in those crypts.
"What did you do for them, Bone? Teach them to read and write? Help them rebuild? Give them Christ? Help restore a culture? Did you remember to warn them that it could never be Eden? Of course you did. Bless you, Bone,"
he thought, and traced a cross on its forehead with his thumb.
"For all your pains, they paid you with an arrow between the eyes, because there's more than 5 tons and 18 centuries of rock back there. I suppose there's about 2 million years of it back there, since the first of Homo Inspiratus."
He heard the voice again, the soft echo voice that had answered him a little while ago. This time it came in a kind of childish sing-song.
La la la, la la la.
Although it seemed to be the same voice he had heard in the confessional, surely it could not be Mrs. Grayles. Mrs. Grayles would have forgiven God and run for home if she had got out of the chapel in time. And please forgive the reversal, Lord. But he was not even sure that it was a reversal.
Listen, old bone, should I have told that to Coors? Listen, my dear Coors, why don't you forgive God for allowing pain? If he didn't allow it, human courage, bravery, nobility, and self-sacrifice would all be meaningless things. Besides, you'd be out of a job, Coors. Maybe that's what we forgot to mention, Bone. Bombs and tantrums, when the world grew bitter because the world fell somehow short of half-remembered Eden. The bitterness was essentially against God. Listen, man, you have to give up the bitterness by granting shriveness to God, as she'd say. Before anything. Before love.
But bombs and tantrums, they didn't forgive. He slept a while. It was natural sleep, and not that ugly, mind-seizing nothingness of the dark. A rain came, clearing the dust. When he awoke, he was not alone. He lifted his cheek out of the mud and looked at them crossly. 3 of them sat on the rubble heap and eyed him with funereal solemnity. He moved. They spread black wings and hissed nervously. He flipped a bit of stone at them. 2 of them took wing and climbed to circle, but the 3rd sat there doing a little shuffle dance and peering at him gravely. a dark and ugly bird, but not like that other dark. This one coveted only the body.
"Dinner's not quite ready, Brother Bird," he told it irritably. "You'll have to wait."
It would not have many meals to look forward to, he noticed, before the bird itself became a meal for another. Its feathers were singed from the flash, and it kept one eye closed. The bird was soggy with rain, and the abbot guessed that the rain itself was full of death.
"La la la, la la la, wait, wait, wait till it dies, la,"
the voice came again. Zerki had feared that it might have been a hallucination, but the bird was hearing it too. It kept peering at something out of Zerki's range of vision. At last it hissed raucously and took wing.
"Help," he shouted weakly.
"Help,"
parroted the strange voice. And the two-headed woman wandered into sight around a heap of rubble. She stopped and looked down at Zerki.
"Thank God, Mrs. Grails. See if you can find Father Leahy."
"Thank God, Mrs. Grails. See if you can..."
He blinked away a film of blood and studied her closely.
"Rachel," he breathed.
"Rachel,"
the creature answered. She knelt there in front of him and settled back on her heels. She watched him with cool green eyes and smiled innocently. The eyes were alert with wonder, curiosity, and perhaps something else, but she could apparently not see that he was in pain. There was something about her eyes that caused him to notice nothing else for several seconds. But then he noticed that the head of Mrs. Grails slept soundly on the other shoulder while Rachel smiled. It seemed a young, shy smile that hoped for friendship. He tried again.
"Listen, is anyone else alive? Get..."
Melodious and solemn came her answer.
"Listen, is anyone else alive?"
She savored the words. She enunciated them distinctly. She smiled over them. Her lips reframed them when her voice was done with them. It was more than reflexive imitation, he decided. She was trying to communicate something. By the repetition, she was trying to convey the idea, "I am somehow like you." But she had only just now been born. "And you are something different, too," Zerki noticed with a trace of awe. He remembered that Mrs. Grails had arthritis in both knees, but the body which had belonged to her was now kneeling there and sitting back on its heels in that limber posture of youth. Moreover, the old woman's wrinkled skin seemed less wrinkled than before, and it seemed to glow a little, as if horny old tissue were being revivified. Suddenly he noticed her arm.
"You're hurt. You're hurt."
Zerki pointed at her arm. Instead of looking where he pointed, she imitated his gesture, looking at his finger and extending her own to touch it, using the wounded arm. There was very little blood, but there were at least a dozen cuts, and one looked deep. He tugged at her finger to bring her arm closer. He plucked out 5 slivers of broken glass. Either she had thrust her arm through a window, or, more likely, had been in the path of an exploding window pane when the blast had come. Only once, when he removed an inch-long lance of glass, did a trace of blood appear. When he pulled the others free, they left tiny blue marks, with no bleeding. The effect reminded him of a demonstration of hypnosis he had once witnessed, of something he had dismissed as a hoax. When he looked up at her face again, his awe increased. She was still smiling at him, as if the removal of the glass splinters had caused her no discomfort. He glanced again at the face of Mrs. Grails. It had grown gray with the impersonal mask of coma. The lips seemed bloodless. Somehow he felt certain it was dying. He could imagine it withering and eventually falling away like a scab or an umbilical cord. Who, then, was Rachel, and what? There was still a little moisture on the rain-wet rocks. He moistened one fingertip and beckoned for her to lean closer. Whatever she was, she had probably received too much radiation to live very long. He began tracing a cross on her forehead with the moist fingertip.
"Nisi baptizata es et nisi baptizari non quis, te baptizo."
He got no farther than that. She leaned quickly away from him. Her smile froze and vanished. No, her whole countenance seemed to shout. She turned away from him. She wiped the trace of moisture from her forehead, closed her eyes, and let her hands lie limply in her lap. An expression of complete passivity came over her face. With her head bowed that way, her whole attitude seemed suggestive of prayer. Gradually, out of the passivity, a smile was reborn. It grew. When she opened her eyes and looked at him again, it was with the same warmth as before, but she glanced around as if searching for something. Her eyes fell on the ciborium. Before he could stop her, she picked it up.
No,
he coughed hoarsely and made a grab for it. She was too quick for him, and the effort cost him a blackout. As he drifted back to consciousness and lifted his head again, he could see only through a blur. She was still kneeling there, facing him. Finally, he could make out that she was holding the golden cup in her left hand, and in her right, delicately between thumb and forefinger, a single host. She was offering it to him. Or was he only imagining it, as he had imagined a while ago that he was talking to Brother Pat? He waited for the blur to clear. This time, it wasn't going to clear, not completely.
Domine, non sum dignus, he whispered, sed tantum dic verbo.
He received the wafer from her hand. She replaced the lid of the ciborium and set the vessel in a more protected spot under a jutting rock. She used no conventional gestures, but the reverence with which she had handled it convinced him of one thing. She sensed the presence under the veils. She, who could not yet use words nor understand them, had done what she had as if by direct instruction, in response to his attempt at conditional baptism. He tried to refocus his eyes to get another look at the face of this being, who, by gestures alone, had said to him, I do not need your first sacrament, man, but I am worthy to convey to you this sacrament of life. Now he knew what she was, and he sobbed faintly when he could not again force his eyes to focus on those cool, green, untroubled eyes of one born free.
Magnificat anima mea Dominum, he whispered.
My soul doth magnify the Lord, and my spirit hath rejoiced in God my Savior, for he hath regarded the lowliness of his handmaid. He wanted to teach her these words as his last act, for he was certain that she shared something with the maiden who first had spoken them.
Magnificat anima mea Dominum, et exultavit spiritus meus in Deo, salutare meo, quia respexit humilitatem.
He ran out of breath before he had finished. His vision went foggy. He could no longer see her form. But cool fingertips touched his forehead, and he heard her say one word.
Live.
Then she was gone. He could hear her voice trailing away in the new ruins.
La la la, la la la.
The image of those cool green eyes lingered with him as long as life. He did not ask why God would choose to raise up a creature of primal innocence from the shoulder of Mrs. Grails, or why God gave to it the preternatural gifts of Eden, those gifts which man had been trying to seize by brute force again from heaven since first he lost them. He had seen primal innocence in those eyes and a promise of resurrection. One glimpse had been a bounty, and he wept in gratitude. Afterwards, he lay with his face in the wet dirt and waited. Nothing else ever came, nothing that he saw or felt or heard. Chapter 30, the last chapter. They sang as they lifted the children into the ship. They sang old space chanties and helped the children up the ladder one at a time and into the hands of the sisters. They sang heartily to dispel the fright of the little ones. When the horizon erupted, the singing stopped. They passed the last child into the ship. The horizon came alive with flashes as the monks mounted the ladder. The horizons became a red glow. A distant cloud bank was born where no cloud had been. The monks on the ladder looked away from the flashes. When the flashes were gone, they looked back. The visage of Lucifer mushroomed into hideousness above the cloud bank, rising slowly like some titan climbing to its feet after ages of imprisonment in the earth. Someone barked an order. The monks began climbing again. Soon they were all inside the ship. The last monk, upon entering, paused in the lock. He stood in the open hatchway and took off his sandals.
Sic transit mundus,
he murmured, looking back at the glow. He slapped the soles of his sandals together, beating the dirt out of them. The glow was engulfing a third of the heavens. He scratched his beard, took one last look at the ocean, then stepped back and closed the hatch. There came a blur, a glare of light, a high, thin, whining sound, and the starship thrust itself heavenward. The breakers beat monotonously at the shores, casting up driftwood. An abandoned seaplane floated beyond the breakers. After a while, the breakers caught the seaplane and threw it on the shore with the driftwood. It tilted and fractured a wing. There were shrimp carousing in the breakers, and the whiting that fed on the shrimp, and the shark that munched the whiting and found them admirable in the sportive brutality of the sea. A wind came across the ocean, sweeping with it a pall of fine white ash. The ash fell into the sea and into the breakers. The breakers washed dead shrimp ashore with the driftwood. Then they washed up the whiting. The shark swam out to his deepest waters and brooded in the old clean currents. He was very hungry that season. This concludes the reading of A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. This book was read by Jonathan Mayrose. Additional titles by Walter M. Miller, Jr. in the Books on Tape Library include Saint Leibowitz and the Wild Horsewoman. For more information about it, or for help with topics of related interest, please call our customer service department, or check our catalog index to find review material. If you have enjoyed these tapes, you may want to consider buying this audiobook and donating it to your local library so that others in your community can enjoy it too. The donation will be deductible to the extent allowable under the law.